Night School 49, aka Not Quite 50. Not Quite 50. That's the name of this episode. And I'm going to be talking about a phrase that I've had on my mind for about the last week, and that is emotional tourism. Emotional tourism, not to be confused with emotional terrorism. I feel like there's some crossover potential there between emotional tourism and emotional terrorism, but that's not really going to be the topic today. I'm going to save it for another time. Although I feel like real-life tourism also crosses over with real-life terrorism, so it's natural that the emotional form would cross over as well. But emotional tourism, what I mean by that is specifically related to entertainment, because I would say most of the entertainment we watch and consume and read is a form of emotional tourism. We want it to take us somewhere that it doesn't always feel good, that kind of pulls at our emotions in different ways. And you see it a lot in real-life TV shows, documentaries. Because most documentaries I've found aren't entirely happy. They're not just about a wonderland out there. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes they tell some quirky story, or they show how something works. But a lot of times they take us to a dark place, a war-ravaged village. They tell a story about a murder. And I feel like true crime documentaries, true crime TV shows, that's sort of a genre unto itself, apart from just documentaries. But I still think those fit into what I'm talking about when I say emotional tourism. I'd say they fit pretty well, actually. And it's something that people want to consume. They can't really get enough of it. They want to hear stories of bad things happening to people. They want to hear stories of people struggling. And it's not, you know, as if they're enjoying the fact that people are suffering in shows or movies or documentaries like this. They often want to see some sort of resolution. They want to see the struggle pay off. They want to see someone overcome something. When they watch the TV show about the guy who was born, with nothing below his kneecaps, who's lived his life in a wheelchair, they want to see where, you know, he finds a wife and raises a family and starts a business and, manages to play kickball with his new fake legs. They want to see that. Because that's one part of it, is we like seeing difficult situations in almost every medium. In almost every form of media, we like seeing and hearing about difficult situations. And we've started to consume those stories, I feel like, at a more rapid rate than ever before. Because a lot of old stories are about struggle. Almost any good story, any story that was passed on through the ages, all the old stories, all those old stories. But they're always about some sort of struggle. They're about someone overcoming a series of challenges and very difficult hardships, which seems like a redundant thing to say. Hard hardships, and then ultimately overcoming them. Not that everything is always, perfect in the end, but a lot of classic stories, heroism, the hero has to overcome a number of challenges, a number of trials. But I think one difference between people back then, people throughout the ages, is people themselves used to experience much more horrifying things on a day-to-day basis. Their children died at birth. The mothers died upon giving childbirth. They experienced a lot more hands-on warfare around them. Things affected them much more brutally. The weather. We talk about the weather, that's a funny thing. We talk about the weather now, and it's like, oh, that's small talk. You don't have anything else to say, so you're just talking about the weather. And there was a time when talking about the weather was really fucking important. I mean, it still is to some people, depending on your situation. If you're a farmer or you're homeless, talking about the weather is really a big deal. If you got a leaky roof. But there was a point in time where, talking about the weather was not small talk. It was big, and you didn't have a weatherman. You didn't have obvious ways of predicting it. You had your own weird pagan way of figuring out what the season was going to bring. But talking to the neighbor about the weather was important fucking information. Anyway, like, you know, people experienced a lot more immediate hardship, and that included nature. Nature was much harder to deal with, way more intimate. And so people weren't, you know, 300 years ago, 400 years ago, thousands of years ago, they weren't sitting there consuming essentially sob stories, because that's a lot of what we consume now. It tends to be marketed toward women. You think about shows like Oprah, where they tell a story of someone who experienced something very difficult early on in their life, and there are tears. There's music that is designed to bring those emotions out of you. And they tell someone's difficult story and show where that person is now, how they've overcome this experience, this abuse, this horrible accident, this situation. And those sorts of stories are everywhere. And not just real life stories, also in fiction, in nonfiction, in movies, in books. It's really everywhere. And I think in some way, if we aren't experiencing those things ourselves, we have some innate need to experience them indirectly, to go through those emotions, you know, as in a voyeuristic way. And that's what I mean when I say emotional tourism. It's like, I want to go there for just an hour. You know, I want to feel really sad for just an hour. You know, I don't want to feel sad all day, but I want to watch something that makes me feel sad for the next hour. An hour-long tour. You know, that's kind of what we do. And it's, you know, something I realized with movies and TV shows, like fictional ones, it's something I've always known, but I had an epiphany about 3 years ago. I was watching I Love Lucy, and I grew up watching a lot of I Love Lucy on Nick at Night, but I was rewatching it about 2 or 3 years ago. And I had this kind of obvious epiphany, but epiphanies are always obvious. Epiphanies are always like, oh, there's that obvious thing that's been in front of me, but I've just never really wrapped my brain. I've never acknowledged it. It's basically an epiphany to me is something that's always been in front of you, but you've just never really managed to acknowledge it. It's almost been too obvious to acknowledge. So obvious that it's invisible. But I was watching I Love Lucy, and I was like, oh, every episode is about stress. Every episode is about, it builds up to a situation that just gets overwhelmingly stressful, and then it kind of resolves itself, you know, and Lucy's, she's either embarrassed, or she embarrasses Ricky, or she, all of the above, but either way, it's just a situation develops in every single episode where an overwhelming amount of stress occurs and chaos, and then it basically, you know, things fall back into place from there. And it's comedy and it's all that, but everything is that way. Everything basically follows that mold. Every movie, it builds you up to a point where you're just completely stressed out. You're vicariously stressed out. You're a tourist, you know, watching a shark, you know, circle a boat, but it's not actually going to eat you. You're just watching it, but you're feeling it. And, you know, every movie is that way. Every decent movie is that way. One way or another, whether it's a drama, it does it with your emotions. It pulls at you. You know, you feel sad, you feel happy. Then it's this up and down. You're scared for this character. You're wondering what the fuck's up with that character. Oh, he said that to her. They're supposed to be in love. You know, you do that with dramas, with love stories, with even a romantic comedy is essentially about that. Oh, there's a misunderstanding. Now you get to feel stressed out until it gets resolved. So I had a joke, like when I had that epiphany and I realized that not just I Love Lucy, but every fucking story you watch or consume in any medium is about stress. I was thinking about, you know, you go into a Blockbuster and you look around and you know how in Blockbuster they used to have, you know, the different genres labeled. The different rows would have a different genre and all the movies would be grouped according to genre. Well, you know, they would still have that, but every single genre marker would just say stress film. The entire fucking place is filled with stress films. It's the only genre, stress film. Because are you going to want to watch something that doesn't have stress, that doesn't take you on an emotional ride? Probably not. You know, I was thinking about this game. If you remember that show, Barney, of course you remember it. I mean, it's hard to forget. Barney the Dinosaur. It was a few years after me. You know, I think that show became popular a few years after I was out of the target age range. So maybe like people 3 or 4 years younger than me were watching it. But a Barney video game came out, and I went over to my neighbor's house, and they had it. And all the game was, it might have been for Sega Genesis or Super Nintendo, I don't remember what. All Sega Genesis games were really dark. The system itself was this like dark black that inevitably looked dusty. No matter how much you cleaned a Sega Genesis, it just looked like this black box covered in dust. And the games themselves, I feel like, had a darker vibe, like visually darker, strangely alien darkness, where Super Nintendo tended to be bright. The graphics were bright, the system was bright. So it'd be strange to me if this Barney game was for Sega Genesis, but I don't know what it was for. But the game was just hide-and-go-seek, and you controlled Barney, and it was a side-scroller, and you went and you found the kids. And the kids would be hiding behind a bush, but like their whole fucking body would be sticking out. Like they were not well hidden at all, because the game was intended for like fucking four-year-olds, you know? It's not like the game is being designed for real video game plays. It was an early experience in irony for me, because I saw that my neighbors had that, and I was like, oh, hell yeah, like, I'm gonna play this. This game's awesome. And it's just, you beat it in, like, 5 minutes. You beat the whole game in 5 minutes, because it's literally just running around on a platform finding not very well-hidden kids. You know, a game like that, it wasn't enjoyable. Like, I kind of ironically pretended to be into it, because it was, an early chance to pretend to be into something that wasn't that cool, and that made it cool. But really, the game was like just so boring, so easy. And you want some difficulty, you want some struggle, you want those kids in that game to be at least a little more well hidden. Their whole bodies were sticking out. And you don't watch movies like that either. You don't watch movies just about pleasure and go, oh, that's awesome, I wish I was there. Look at that. Oh, man, they got like, oh, man, look at that couch and all that cotton candy. Man, that's fucking paradise. Nothing bad ever happens in the entire movie. It's just people sitting on couches eating cotton candy. And you look at shows like American Idol, too. It's they harp on the same thing. And they tend to be more, because, you know, emotional tourism is one thing. You willingly, you know, having these removed experiences of watching some form of entertainment. And that's, let me just say that real quick, entertainment. You think about that word, and to me, when I hear it, I think, oh, pleasure. It's called entertainment because it's pleasurable. But most entertainment isn't necessarily pleasurable. If there's a resolution to the story, if things work out in the end, there's a pleasure to that, because that's, you know, the end of the roller coaster. You feel good, you feel elated. But the whole entertainment experience isn't just pleasure. The entertainment just means I feel like your attention is on it. It's something that keeps your attention. And things that are just pleasurable don't usually keep our attention. I mean, you see it in reality with drugs and, you know, any kind of addiction. You know, people who are sex addicts, they begin to, you know, lose the joy. They no longer enjoy these things that they overindulge in. You have to have this kind of struggle. Like if you've been waiting all day to get high and you get high, that's way better than just being high all day. If you've been looking forward to getting cotton candy at the fair and you finally get it, that's so much better than, you know, having a fucking cotton candy store next door and going there all day. Store next door. So part of, you know, what makes things entertaining to us is this arc. And, you know, we want to be these tourists who aren't just, you know, going, you know, it's almost more of an adventure than it is a real tour. Because you think of a tourist and they're really not engaged in anything. They're not actually participating, but we aren't either. You know, we're not participating in the experience either. So I don't think we can really call ourselves emotional adventurers. We're just these emotional tourists. We experience it all vicariously. There's a boundary between us. There's a little fence. We're just looking through it. And, you know, going back to the Barney thing, it's like the idea of playing an entire game where there's no struggle, you know, there's no fun in that. And, of course, for a four-year-old, that's a good way to, you know, develop cognitive abilities and develop the ability to spot things, these kids sticking out of bushes. But, you know, video games as you get older, of course, need to be complicated. They need to be difficult. Even if it's a game that's visually beautiful, if it's an RPG. I mean, one of my favorite parts about role-playing games growing up was exploring the cool little villages, new castles, new characters. But do I want to play a game about a utopia where you're just wandering around talking to people and looking at cool things? No, I wouldn't play that. You know, you want to go through the storyline of fighting the Imperial Army and, you know, gaining access to those new towns that you can explore because you beat some giant snake in a cave. You know, you want to go through all that in order to experience the stuff that is visually pleasing and pleasant and mellow. A game that's just the pleasant and mellow aspects isn't fun to watch. But to go back to the idea that I was talking about of people in olden days, not really experiencing any of that. You know, they would hear these grand stories, these stories of heroes. And those were much different than just sitting there every day and watching stories about people's tragic lives. It's much different than that. But as I was saying, they themselves were experiencing it. So it's almost as if we have this inherent need to have those experiences, whether they're happening to us or whether we're simply watching them. We have this need to experience tragedy and experience hardship, even if it's vicarious, even if we are just tourists looking at it through a fence. We have this need for that. And I also wonder what it's done to us to watch these things. What has it done to us as people to watch TV shows about someone born, you know, without an arm and what they've had to go through and their trials and tribulations? What does it do to us as an entire species to watch shows like that and cry about it? And, you know, I've heard it pointed out before that people who actually do still experience hardship, of which there are many, I'm not saying that we live in a world where there are no people experiencing true hardship, even in the United States, even in any Western country, there are still people who are very poor, people who live in very bad areas, people who see violence on a regular basis, and I would bet those people are less likely to watch that stuff. I bet somebody who, you know, lives in a bad neighborhood where there are shootings and, you know, fights and theft all the time, I bet that person is way less likely to watch sob story documentaries. I don't know. I'm just guessing. But, you know, since many of us do live much more comfortable lives than our ancestors, and so many of us are watching these things, I wonder what effect it has had on us. I mean, I have to imagine it creates more empathy. I have to imagine knowing that certain people go through things that we can't even imagine creates more empathy in us. And maybe we have a tendency to take that with us when we go out into the world and think, you know, maybe these people around me at the store are going through harder shit than I thought. You know, I want to get mad at them for getting in my way. I want to get mad at this guy for not using his turn signal. But who the fuck knows what his story is? I mean, I still get mad at people not using their turn signal. But still, maybe it just gives us slightly more empathy when we go out and do things. And you can always see people losing their shit. You can always see people getting mad at each other. You'll find hostility if you look for it. But we do live in an age where people are less violent overall than before. Sure, we have the freak shootings that, you know, tend to happen quite a bit in the U.S. We still can point out war and violence, things happening around the world, but there is less immediate violence going on around us. And statistics back that up. We live in a far less violent world, at least in this part of the world. At least in the Western part of the world, we live in a far less violent world than we did hundreds of years ago, even 100 years ago. I mean, look at the way boys don't grow up fighting each other anymore. People used to grow up and they would just fight. People would just beat each other up. That doesn't happen nearly as often. I don't think people are as brutal as they once were. People are much more sensitive, and that comes with its own problems. But I have to wonder if watching all these stories that tug at our heartstrings have sort of opened something up. And you know, I think a lot of these shows are geared toward women, so it's not like men are watching this, but you do see it play out on a mainstream level. And something I was going to get into a few minutes ago before I started talking about something else, before I started talking about Barney, you know, was the way that I think this emotional this need for humans to see these things, this need for emotional tourism where it can be manipulated, because there's so much emotional manipulation. So much out there is just preying, P-R-E-Y-ing, on the fact that people have a need to look at this stuff and react to it and experience it through their screens. And you see that on American Idol, where whenever they want to hype somebody up, they will tell a sob story. You know, oh, this guy, he gave up his dreams to be a country music star so that he could raise his son. And his wife left him, and, you know, he's just doing his best to raise his son. And he, you know, but he still writes these songs. He still sings his songs, you know, on his break, on his work, on his when he's on his break at work in between shifts of his three jobs. He's still writing country music. Vote for him. You know, you see that. You don't see American Idol talk about someone who's just had a perfect life. You don't see them tell that person's story. Oh, this kid, he's descended from royalty. His father, his great 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 grandfather was the king of England. His great 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 grandfather was the king of England. His parents were lawyers. Both of his parents, two of the top 10 lawyers in the entire United States. His grandfather, he found gold and oil on the same day. Would you believe it? This family has just had nothing but success. This kid's life has been perfect. Captain of the football team, hottest girlfriend. You should see his fucking girlfriend. Oh, my God. And now vote for him. He's also got a great fucking voice. Vote for him. You don't hear that story on American Idol. People aren't going to vote for that kid. Even if he has the best voice, they're not going to want to vote for the kid who's had the perfect life. Instead, what you're going to hear is, check out this woman who was born without eyeballs. She never had eyeballs. And, you know, her dog, when her dog died, it donated its eyeballs to her. So now she's got eyeballs, but she still can't see through them, and they look like weird fucking dog eyeballs. But, you know, she is on American Idol. But guess what? Her daughter was born with the same disease, and she don't have eyeballs either. And so if the mom wins American Idol, she's going to get a new dog who, when it dies, it's going to donate its eyeballs to the little girl. So the mom and little girl will have matching dog eyeballs. And that way everybody's going to know they're related. Because right now nobody knows their mother and daughter. They don't look alike. But if they have matching dog eyeballs, everybody will know. Vote for her. You know, that's what you're going to hear on American Idol. I would fucking vote for that singer, that singer. You're not going to hear the story of goodness. We like the struggle. We love it. And I think we actually like it in our own lives when it happens. I don't mean that we like bad things to happen to us. But if you've noticed, anytime you're going through something really serious, something happens to a family member, something happens to you, it could be about you. It doesn't have to be about somebody else, but if something happens to somebody that's important to you, whether that's you or a family member or just something big happens in your life that kind of shocks you to your core, it shakes all the bullshit out of the tree. You know, all that bullshit you've been caring about, all those judgments, all that gossip, all those complaints about nonsense, about your burger being not the way you wanted it last night, and how the burger over across the street would have been better. All that bullshit that you've complained about, you know, falls out of the tree. And I think that's, you know, sort of what these stories do to us in a weird way. While we are experiencing them, it shakes other things out of the tree. It's like, oh, I'm really worried about what's going to happen to this character. I'm really concerned. I'm really concerned that, you know, the guy in the rom-com delivered his love letter to the apartment next door instead of the one where the girl lives, and now it's the old lady next door thinks that the guy's in love with her, and now we have to spend the next hour resolving that situation because everybody thinks he's into old women and not into the main girl, you know. you know, we want it even in, like, rom-coms. We want it in every possible story. But I think it's true even physically. I noticed that when I work myself very hard physically in fitness, you know, I feel much better. I feel less concerned with the bullshit in my life. It definitely shakes some things loose. And, you know, you go back to the days when people were struggling more physically on a day-to-day basis. They had to walk everywhere. They had to hunt for food. And I bet those people didn't really care as much about bullshit. And I bet they didn't have a need, though, to fit, you know, stories of like other people's hardships into their life. Maybe, you know, they cared about, you know, their tribe, like another member of their tribe was going through something. Maybe they wanted to help them, but they didn't like go to the village elder and be like, tell me the story about the guy born without toes. You know, when you're spending all day like hunting squirrels just to make it through the winter, you probably don't care about those stories. But you might want to hear a story about the great hero who, you know, had to climb a mountain and then dig a hole in the ground and tunnel under the castle in order to go up and kill the fucking evil king. You know, because even those stories aren't that simple. You know, just like with American Idol, you know, in American Idol, it's a fucking huge story. Oh, you know, you're a great singer. You enter this really difficult national contest where people, more people are voting for you than people vote for the president. And you won. You won like this big fucking, it's not like, you know, obviously I don't care about American Idol, but I'm just saying you won the contest, but that's not good enough. We have to tell another story. We have to tell the story about how you climbed the mountain, you know, with your grandmother strapped to your back and then dug a tunnel and, you know, burrowed under the couch. You know, you have to tell that part of the story. Like in the same way that you can't just tell a story about a hero who, oh yeah, he snuck into the castle, killed the evil king and took the princess home and that's it. You know, you have to tell this whole buildup, you know, that goes into that. It's not just as simple as everything was great. He hung out in the, like, let's say you're writing a fantasy book and it's like, oh, there's 50 chapters about how he just spends all day in the garden drinking wine and looking at butterflies. And then the last chapter is like, oh, and then finally he went into the castle and killed the evil king and saved the princess. No, all those 50 chapters have to be filled with 50 other hardships that he underwent on the way. You know, he had to go through all of that on the way. And if there's, you know, a little bit about something pleasurable along the way, you know, that's fine. We like to hear about that, but we don't want it to be just that. And music is kind of the same way. I'm thinking more of stories that have a true, you know, A to B narrative, a more linear narrative. Like the story could go anywhere, but, you know, music is more abstract, you know, but still it communicates to us emotionally. I would say a difference with music is that we often want to listen to music that reflects how we are already feeling. We like to go, I'm feeling sad, so I'm going to listen to a sad song. I'm feeling angry, so I'm going to listen to an angry song. You know, that's what we tend to do. We tend to, oh, I need to work out. I'm going to listen to music that's going to hype me up. I'm going to listen to the Rocky theme. We don't tend to go, I'm going to listen to a sad song for a little bit just to kind of like explore the emotion of sadness for just a little bit, for an hour tour of sadness. We don't tend to do that with music. I'd say I do, you know, I'd say I do approach music that way. I'm not the kind of person who listens to music just to reflect how I'm feeling at any given time, but I would say people in general do. You know, I do like to go down that road. And I mean, it's the same for drugs. You think about drugs and it's like some people are like, oh, I smoke weed just because I want to sit on the couch. I like to eat potato chips and I like to just sit on the couch and play video games. I just, it's pleasure. You know, but if you've ever had, you know, bouts of anxiety or just paranoia or just weird existential terror when you're stoned, some people experience that and they're like, oh my God, that's awful. You know, something went wrong. But for, you know, some other people, they see that as an opportunity where it's like, well, you know, that negative feeling that I got when I was high was an echo of something that's actually happening inside of me all the time. And maybe I should just sit on that, even though the next 2 hours are going to be fucking hell. And I'm going to be paranoid and worried about every weird little thing, even the good things. I'm going to be worried for the next 2 hours, even about the good things in my life. But you, if you approach that and go, but this is an opportunity, this is an interesting experience, this is a trial I can go through. It's not fun, and it might make you not want to smoke weed again for a while. God knows I've been there, and I'm not smoking weed right now. Read into that how you want. You know, some people would see that and be like, this isn't how it's supposed to work. I'm supposed to get stoned and, you know, sit on the couch and follow all the stereotypes. Whereas, you know, I think you can look at it and be like, well, this is allowing me to experience a certain set of emotions that I didn't expect. sort of, you know, a weird form of very deep and personal emotional tourism. It's a trial. It's an emotional trial. But still, it's like you're approaching drugs not as a source of pleasure, but as something that will take you through certain experiences, good and bad and otherwise. And I think that, you know, if you look at entertainment, entertainment is absolutely the same thing. And once again, though, if you've ever had that experience where you're on a drug, I think a psychedelic trip is a great example. If you've just been tripping and you get to a very dark, scary place where things don't make sense, but you're gripped with anxiety and fear, when you come down from that trip, you feel so amazing. Reality feels so great. And it's the same thing with fitness. It's the same thing with if you've ever gone on a really hard run and really pushed yourself. And you're just covered in sweat and your legs hurt. But once you're done and that water hits your lips, you're like, this feels so fucking good. Having gone through all that feels so good. So there is this need to go through difficult situations. But I think that's one where you can't simulate it. It's not like watching a show. It's not like watching a TV show about somebody who, you know, all their kids were born with the same disorder and their life is a barely manageable ball of chaos. You know, it's like you can't really experience that. Or maybe you can. I don't know. I mean, something interesting to me is, you know, football is very much what I'm talking about here. Football itself is this up and down game. You know, it's you experience so many emotions. And, you know, even though I love football and I watch as much football as I can, NFL football at least, I don't care about these college boys. You know, it's not really that pleasurable, you know, a lot of the time. If you love a team, it's just, it's mostly stress. When they're doing well, you're worried they're going to do something to fuck up. When they're doing badly, that speaks for itself. Watching your favorite NFL team do badly is, you know, just a miserable experience. You're just sitting there being miserable. There's nothing fun about that. Maybe you can find something to make fun of. Maybe you can find something to, you know, some sort of silver lining in the horror of watching your favorite team fail. But it's very much the same thing. And I think it's interesting that the Game of Thrones author, George Martin, he's a big football fan. And I think it's interesting that I haven't read the books. I recently bought them. I've seen the series, but I've never actually read his books. It's on my list. But it is interesting that he wrote this story that's known for taking you in all these emotional directions. Oh, you got a favorite character? He's dead. He's dead. You know, and you think about him. He's a football fan. So he probably went through all those emotions as a football fan, and that probably translated to his fantasy world. Who knows? Who knows? I just thought of that because I knew he was a football fan. But I do feel that, you know, in my own way, watching football is a form of emotional tourism. You see people who are just, you see players fucking lose the Super Bowl and cry on the sidelines and you feel terrible. You see players just win a big game and have just some incredible moment and celebrate and you vicariously feel it. We essentially, you know, we approach everything in that same way. We are emotional tourists with almost everything we consume. You know, stuff, and it's often stuff that we're not experiencing firsthand, hence the tourism. And we just have this need for difficulty. And I think, you know, I don't know, I do think it's beneficial on a on an empathetic level, you know, for developing your empathy to see things that are difficult, to see people who are going through difficult situations, and to hear stories. Not on the news, though. I don't think the news really fits into what I'm talking about here, because I think the news tends to be inherently negative. I think when real life stories, stories of difficulty are presented in documentaries and other shows, they're sort of stylized in a certain way. But with the news, it tends to just be this like sock to the gut. There's not really that much constructive about it. There's not really that much to take from it. It's like, oh, I want to be aware. I watch the news so I can be aware of everything, you know. I can be aware of everybody who got hit by a car today. I can be aware of every stabbing. You know, most of the time it's not really going to help you. You know, it's a good idea to be aware of what's going on in the world around you, in your community. But I don't think the news is really doing much for us. I think the news is just this dark indulgence. And doesn't really fit into what I'm talking about here. I can't really find the silver lining in the news anymore. Because it used to be a real service. You know, you used to watch the news a couple times a day. It wouldn't be on all day. It wasn't a 24-hour service. It was the newspaper, and then when TV came about, you know, the evening news. Now it's this 24-hour cycle where it's just suck to the gut, all day. Maybe you get punched in the face once just to get a little relief, just to give your gut a little bit of a relief. But it still does fit in a way, because, I mean, people who watch the news, I feel like they're just on the heroin of emotional tourism. You know, while other people might just be treating emotional tourism like, oh, let's smoke this joint, they might watch a Lifetime movie, and that's just the equivalent of smoking a joint, whereas the person who's just glued to the 24-hour news networks is basically on the heroin of emotional tourism. And you'll find, though, I think that if you put yourself in, you know, physically difficult situations, I'm not saying put yourself in under emotional hardship. I don't think it's healthy to find situations that are going to make you go through mental trials that you don't need to go through. Life will present enough of that as it is if you just live even a normal life. But I do encourage people to put their bodies through certain hardship, to work out, to even just walk, even go for a hard walk once a week, twice a week. You know, do that as often as you need to, and I think you'll find that you don't need to be glued to the heroin of the news, or, you know, you don't necessarily need to indulge in as much stuff that pulls at you. You know, you just, if stuff is like pushing your body in one direction or another, I mean, I think the same goes for studying, the same goes for pushing your mind, you know, reading, you know, studying and learning. You know, because that can be very difficult, especially trying to wrap your brain around ideas that you might not agree with right off the bat. If you spend your time kind of trying to study things that you're not entirely comfortable with, I think that sort of serves a similar purpose and creates empathy too. You know, just like watching a documentary about someone with no legs might help create more empathy for, you know, the humans around you. I think that trying to understand someone's viewpoint who you might otherwise disagree with will help build empathy for that person, assuming they're not just a total piece of shit. But even then, why not give it a chance? Why not just see if there is something there, just a little bit of something there? So that's another form of difficult situation, is disagreeable people. And I don't feel like there's enough out there in entertainment telling us to do that. I think that there is a lot out there in entertainment that is telling us to overcome difficulty, to struggle a little bit, you know, to find a groove in that struggle and, you know, improve your life, you know, against the odds. There are so many stories about that. But I don't really see enough stories about handling simple disagreements. And right now we live in a time where things are very black and white. You know, good and bad is clearly defined, and of course, the people on one side see themselves as inherently good, the other people as inherently bad, and vice versa. And that's something that's always been there. Every story throughout time has good and bad. Every group of people, every tribe sees themselves as good, fighting the bad guy. But I feel like we had entered a period with a little more moral ambiguity. You kind of saw it. I think you can use superheroes and action heroes as a great example, where in the 1970s, well, in the early days, like when superheroes, Superman, all those DC characters were first created in, say, the 1950s, I don't know if I have the decade right, but let's just go with the 1950s, the sort of characters you saw, the superheroes, the action heroes, they were very cut and dry. They were nerds by today's standard. They might have been muscular, they might have had superpowers, but they were nerds, and they were very conservative, and I don't mean politically. They were just these very cut and dry, boring characters. And that's what we wanted. That sort of reflected our society and what we were looking for. And these characters were fucking mind-blowing. I mean, you think about Superman. That kind of character, you know, was something totally new. But you go into the 60s and then the 70s, and by the 70s, you know, that sort of guy in the red cape, that sort of typical guy with his hands on his hips and, you know, just a very kind of conservative superhero that was, you know, fading out. And you had characters like Shaft. You had superheroes becoming more cool. You know, the revolution of the 60s had already come and gone. And by the 70s, you know, drug culture was big. Rock and roll had been here for a while. These new weird musics were developing. Musics with an X. And, you know, you had characters like Shaft, you think about that, where he's a cool guy who fights crime. You had these cool guys, these sort of counterculture heroes, not anti-heroes, but sort of counterculture heroes. And there was something morally ambiguous about them. They weren't really dark, but they were kind of street and they were kind of cool. They were hip. And then you see in the 80s, especially the 80s comic underground, you start to see these anti-heroes develop, the Crow, and then by the very early 90s, Spawn, you know, Cerberus, that little aardvark pig guy from the 80s. You had these different independent comics that got popular where they were much darker, and the hero wasn't really a hero. He didn't want to be a hero. And he was cool in a way. He looked cool. You know, he had something edgy about him, but he was, you know, did some things that weren't entirely heroic. You know, he was kind of looking out for himself, and even then, not really looking out for himself, so not really looking out for anybody. You think about Spawn, where he, you know, he hates himself, and that was something you started to see in the 80s, and then that became mainstream, you know, by the early 90s. You know, it kind of went hand in hand with grunge music becoming big. There was movies started to reflect that. There was something very nihilistic going on. Nihilism was still a slight sense of purpose, but ultimately, you know, it was all washed in this moral ambiguity. It wasn't Superman and Spider-Man fighting the bad guys, the obvious bad guys. It was these guys who otherwise might look and kind of act like bad guys, kind of begrudgingly fighting even worse bad guys. And a lot of stories, you know, you saw that play out. It wasn't just in the superheroes. It was a lot of stories, a lot of dramas, a lot of different comics and just all kinds of things. Books that got popular during the 90s reflected that. And I think you saw that in our society, too. And society was doing really well at the time. That's the thing, too. The economy was great. We hadn't been in any major wars for a while. We had that little excursion into Iraq, the first Gulf War. But really, you know, things were pretty peaceful, pretty stable. People were making money, and we enjoyed seeing these morally ambiguous anti-heroes and seeing these other stories play out, even just dramas play out without really a clear good and bad. TV shows started to show that. And I think a great example of kind of the culmination of that to me was The Sopranos, which to me is one of the best shows of all time. It's my favorite show of all time, but definitely one of the best of all time. And you look at the character Tony Soprano, where I've thought this before. I'm like, do I like Tony? I've watched that series all the way through from beginning to end twice, which is saying something because I don't really watch stuff very often. And I've watched random episodes many other times. One of my all-time favorites. There are other characters I like, characters who you don't really see the full dimensions of who they are. They might do some shitty mobster things to people, but for the most part, they're just kind of, you know, comedic relief. Think about a character like Polly Walnuts, someone like that, where you mostly laugh at them, even though they're vicious killers, you mostly laugh at them. But then you see Tony, where you see all the dimensions of him, and he's not really an anti-hero because he doesn't do anything heroic. You know, he does his acts of what would be called heroism are more just acts of normalcy. Oh, look, he cares about his kids. Oh, he bought his wife, you know, something because he's been cheating on her and he finally did something nice for her. You know, you see him do these more normal kind things, or occasionally you'll see this little lapse into morality. For many of us, you know, we lapse into immorality sometimes. For a guy like Tony Soprano, he'll have some small, short-term lapse into morality. Like when he gets upset when the guy kills the stripper, you know. you see that, and I was thinking about this, and it's like, I don't really like Tony. At no point in the series did I find him one of my favorite characters, but yet there's no doubt he's the protagonist. And there's also no doubt that, you know, he's got your attention. And that's an interesting part of a story, the idea of not necessarily liking the main character. Because it's one thing to not like the main character because they're not interesting or they're boring. If you've ever started a book and you've read, you know, a little ways in and you're just like, this character just fucking sucks. I don't care what this character does. You know, the other characters don't make up for it. I can't read this book because I don't give a fuck about this character. That's a much different story than a story where you find the character unlikable as a person. You are interested in what they're doing. You're interested in who they are, but you simply don't support them. That's much different, and that's sort of what The Sopranos played out. And that's why that show was so revolutionary, because it wasn't, you know, there was nothing really redeeming about Tony when you look at his overall actions in life. The bad far outweighed the good. Yet you found yourself kind of reserving judgment and just watching his story play out. And that's sort of the ultimate moral ambiguity, watching a story about a mobster caring about him in some way. You're caring about this mobster and his life, but at the same time, you know he's a piece of shit a lot of the time, and you don't necessarily like him. So that's interesting, and that's very, you know, that show was, I think they filmed the pilot in 1998, and it's very of that time, and then that sort of set the mold for a lot of popular shows to come. You saw Breaking Bad, I think even Mad Men, which I've never watched, kind of, you know, the main character makes some, you know, morally ambiguous decisions, I'm sure, and a lot of shows are like that, even Game of Thrones, especially Game of Thrones, it's just filled with moral ambiguity. So we really came, the pendulum fully swung in that direction, and you saw a lot of the philosophy of the time go into, oh, well, the world isn't black and white. People aren't black and white. You know, everything exists in this gray area. But I think where we're at right now is things are swinging back into this black and white. And I think you can also see that back then, like just to go back to that, where, you know, in the 90s, yeah, there were Democrats and Republicans and people disagreed about things and there were opinions on this and that. And some people hated each other. But I would say, you know, in the same way that the characters that we started to pay attention to kind of fit into this gray area, I would say we did too. We didn't really try to, you know, we didn't really consider ourselves morally superior to the person next door because we, you know, believed in this one, because we voted one way and they voted the other way. I'm sure those people existed. God knows they did. But you didn't see it spilling out into the, you know, the national narrative. You didn't hear it talked about all the time. And the shows reflected that, where it was like we were willing to, you know, reserve our judgment a little bit simply to watch a good story play out. But now here we are, and I think the pendulum is swinging, because we see that throughout history. We see trends and things swing one way, and then they swing another way. You know, for 10 years, it's really popular to have cars that have a roundish design. All the edges are rounded, and then people get sick of that, and they're like, you know what would be really cool? Cars were really boxy. I wouldn't mind a really boxy car as something different since all these round cars are all over the place. And then people start making boxy cars. And then every car is boxy. And then 10 years later, people are like, you know what would be cool? Round car. It's just this back and forth. And you know, there's change. There's progress within that. It's not like we just go from one thing to the other. And it's just everything's the same. You know, it's not like the pattern is the same over time. There is change. But we do see this pendulum swing. And right now, I think things are swinging back toward a more black and white. We're certainly treating each other in more black and white terms. But I think we're going to see stories play out that way, too. I think we're going to start seeing stories popular TV shows, popular books. I think they're going to tell more of a classic good versus bad storyline. I could be wrong. You know, maybe it'll be all of the above. We certainly live in a world that can include virtually anything these days. We have enough people, enough modes of expression that I think we can fit everything under the sun into the box right now. But I do think on a larger level, the zeitgeist, haven't used that word ever, I think the zeitgeist is kind of, you know, flowing toward this more black and white way of thinking of things. And I think that'll be good to some extent. I think having black and white stories could have some benefit. I think that we need to get back to the reality that right and wrong are real. Those decisions are real. We can't always meet the ideal. We can't always be completely right. You know, it's not to say there's only right and wrong, but there is an absolute right and there is an absolute wrong for most situations. It's just that we ourselves are not always absolutely right or absolutely wrong. But watching other people's stories, watching how other people deal with right and wrong, watching other people's ups and downs, other people's difficulties through these stories, going on these emotional tours, I don't think it's wrong. You know, there's a part of me that just immediately rejects it, and I don't know if that's just some, you know, male thing, like who wants to sit around and watch movies and cry? You know, I don't know if it's just that or if it's, I don't know what it is. But I don't think that it's entirely bad that we as a species do that. I do feel like it cultivates empathy, maybe more empathy than we would otherwise have, especially because we're not seeing those things in the flesh. We are not seeing the horrors of life every day like we used to. If you live a middle-class life, you simply do not see all of the bad things going on. So being exposed to it, you know, just with a little, with a screen between you, with a fence between you, I think that's probably good. As long as you don't overindulge, as long as you're not a 24-hour news junkie, I think it's probably good for you. But as I was saying, you know, I think that it will be also good if our fictional stories, if the stories that we read, if the stories that we watch in movies kind of follow that black and white. And I do think that trend is already happening, because just like I was saying how, you know, in the 90s, the superheroes started to be anti-heroes, Spawn and The Crow. We saw a trend, you know, over the last decade or so where all these superhero movies are back in the theater. You know, all these Marvel heroes, all these, you know, much more traditional. And of course, Marvel superheroes were way different than Superman, and they added their own new dimensions to things. But still, compared to the anti-hero era, you know, these characters are much more traditional, and something in us wanted that. Something in the public wanted to see Iron Man and Spider-Man and those characters on the screen instead of these characters in black who are like, I don't want to help anybody. I only helped them because it was an accident. You know, you know, people don't necessarily want to see the hero of the story say shit like that. So I think that trend has already started, and I think it's played out in seeing these much more good guy characters in movies. I don't know if the 80s action movies will come back. I don't know if we'll see that. I don't know what we'll see. I'm hoping for some new stories, period. It's been a long time since I feel like I've really been exposed to a new type of story. You know, most fantasy plays on the stereotypical fantasy characters and themes. Most sci-fi does that. Most action movies. We have kind of put ourselves in a box, hence the remakes, hence all this stuff that's been going on that's just been, you know, drumming at the same ideas. I hope we do see some new ideas, but I wouldn't mind if they were black and white, because I don't think black and white ideas mean that people have to be black and white. I think that people are allowed to exist in gray areas as long as they are striving toward right and wrong.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave, this golden land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me.